You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome this evening. Welcome to Brookings. We're very happy to have you with us so late in the day. The weather has held for us. It's a beautiful, almost spring day, and we're glad to have you with us. The audience tonight will have the opportunity to hear the lecture, and we're also live streamed as well. So for those of you coming in from outside the Brookings Institution, you're most welcome to join us this evening. I have the honor this evening of introducing the Raymond Aron Lecture, which is an annual series co-organized by Brookings Center for U.S. and European Studies, the Embassy of France to the United States, and the policy planning staff of the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. This lecture, which was launched in 2004, is named for Raymond Aron, a renowned scholar of the post-war France and a great defender of liberal democracy and a friend of the United States. Over the years, this lecture has become a well-established and prominent forum for leading French scholars and officials and their American counterparts to speak on critical issues affecting the transatlantic relationship. Let me first take a moment to thank our partners at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs, at the French Embassy. The French Ambassador Gérard Aron has been a great friend of Brookings and a frequent guest in these halls, and he'll be greatly missed when he leaves Washington at the end of April. We're also joined this evening by a member of the German Bundestag, Johannes Vogel, and we welcome you this evening to Brookings, sir. Ambassador Aron unfortunately couldn't be with us for the lecture this evening, but I do have the opportunity to welcome the Embassy's Deputy Chief of Mission, Nathalie Broadhurst. Thank you, madam. We're very grateful for your presence this evening and for the great support of the Embassy. The topic for this evening's lecture is the immigration challenge in a divided Europe. And it is our distinct pleasure to have Dr. François Errin with us to provide this lecture for this evening. Dr. Errin is the Migrations and Societies Chair at the Collège de France in Paris. He is the founder and director of the Interdisciplinary Institute of Migrations under the auspices of the French National Center for Scientific Research. And he's previously served over 10 years as the head of the French National Institute for Demographic Research. In his lecture, Dr. Herron will discuss the ongoing immigration debate through a sociological and demographic lens. He will also compare immigration policies put in place in Europe and in the United States and identify the factors behind the diversity of migration patterns across the Western world. And this could not be a more timely and important subject, Doctor. So thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us this evening. We're also honored this evening to be joined tonight by Georgetown University Adjunct Professor Anne Richard. Anne is joining us from the Institute of the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University, where she was also a 2018 Centennial Fellow. Prior to her current position, she was the Assistant Secretary at State for Population, Refugees, and Migration in the Obama administration in 2012 and 2017. And I have to say, it was my great honor when I was assigned to the State Department to work closely with Anne during a very, very difficult time in the Middle East associated with the Islamic State and its explosion onto the scene and the refugees and migration that resulted. And last but not least, our own Celia Bellon will moderate tonight's conversation. Celia is a visiting fellow in the Center for United States and Europe here at Brookings. Prior, she served for 5 years in policy planning staff at the French Foreign Ministry. So in a few minutes, I'll welcome Dr. Aron to the stage for his lecture. After the lecture, Anne and Celia will join him on stage for a moderated discussion and questions and answers with the audience. And a final reminder that we are on the record very much today and we're streaming live. So those of you on the Internet, you're most welcome to join us, as we always do. So with that, Doctor, we welcome you to the stage and thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for this introduction. I'm very grateful to the Brookings Institution and to the French Embassy for this invitation. I'm very glad to honored to add my name to this prestigious series of the Brookings researchers, the invitees to the Brookings Institution. Well, as you know, demographers are attached to facts. We love facts. And I think that in these rough times, it's important to give an idea of the order of magnitudes of all the phenomena we are talking about. And it's very important, according to me, to objectify the debate with data. And fortunately, we have now more and more precise data on migration issues, especially because of the work, the harmonizing work of Eurostat, especially OECD, has done work, considerable work, to gather reliable data on migrations. And so I'll just make a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary migrations, a very empirical distinction, but it's useful, I think. And I'll begin with extraordinary migration. So this huge inflows and sudden inflows of refugees from the Near East, Middle East. And let's just take the first year of the so-called migrant crisis in 2016, and these are the absolute number. And the way the number of asylum seekers who whose dossiers have been dealt with, have been treated by the different countries across Europe. As you can see, and as you know, Germany had a very huge number of applicants. I had to cut the bar because it's out of the graph, of course, and 750,000 applicants have been treated in this year, 2016, and more or less nearly 60% of them have obtained protection from the German government. And France comes in the second rank by the number of applications, but in the fourth by the number of positive decisions. But of course, this kind of comparison doesn't make sense because countries have different sizes. And in order to control for the size of the population and to some extent to take into account the receiving capacity, which is, of course, proportional to the population, to the size of the country, it's absolutely indispensable to have to make calculation per capita. Yeah, that is, controlling for the population, size of population, how many positive decisions have been issued for asylum seekers across Europe. And you can see that Sweden is ahead with 4,500 positive decision of protection to asylum seekers per 1 million inhabitants. And then Germany, Austria, etc. You see that the average, European average, is about 1,000, and France is nearly at the middle of this average, which is rather different from the general discourse which obtains in France about our generosity in terms of asylum. We are, in fact, occupying the 17th rank in Europe by our capacity to give protection to asylum seekers. And we are more or less at the same level as Italy. We don't have any lesson to give to Italy. Italy has no lesson to give to us. We are approximately at the same level. But UK is doing worse, and UK is taking advantage of its isolation and insulation. And its position, of course, UK has a lot of ordinary migrants coming from Central Europe, but this is about asylum seekers. And you can see, I don't know if the mouse is working. No, so I have well, it doesn't matter. So, as you, some countries occupy a bizarre position in this graph. For example, Malta and Cyprus. Malta and Cyprus, of course, are victims, I could say, of the doubling regulation. They have to cope in first line with the arrival of refugees, and this explains why they are inserted between Austria, Switzerland, Norway, these rich countries. You can see also that Spain in the right place and Portugal are in a very low position, but this is explained by the fact that these countries have been for a very long time immigration countries and not emigration countries, so they were not equipped from the legal point of view to deal with my asylum applications. Contrary to France, receives asylum seekers since the 19th century. And all the countries, the end of the distribution has been put on the right side of the graph, and the red spot corresponds to ex-communist countries. These countries share some specificities. They have never been accustomed to non-European migrations during the reconstruction years, post-war reconstruction years. They don't have any colonial past, and of course, a colonial past plays a very important role to special channels between the metropolis and the colonies. And they also have developed this national narrative based on Christianity against Islam, which plays a very important role in their narrative. What is important is we are fascinated by the speeches, by the discourse of Viktor Orban, but in fact all the ex-communist countries of Central Europe are doing exactly the same, from the Baltic countries to Slovenia, exactly the same. So there is no correlation between the political regime of these countries and the way they behave towards asylum seekers. There are deep reasons and not only political reasons. If we summarize the comparison between France and Germany, the way the two countries behave vis-à-vis asylum seekers, it must be summarized that way. Just look at the last line of the slide. We received five times less asylum seekers than Germany, and we gave a positive decision to 10 times less people. The problem is why? How can we explain such huge differences between European countries? If you get back to this graph between Poland, 14 asylum seekers obtaining a positive decision of protection compared to Sweden. There are just a little sea between those two countries. And this difference is a huge gap. It's very rare to find so many, so huge differences between countries across Europe. So let's take an experimental case, which is Germany. Germany is still marked deeply by the difference between West and East. And here is, in the last census they took in 2011, the share of population of migrants and their children, so first and second generation summed up, all the German population mit Migrationshintergrund, as they say, according to the Länder. And you see that the last five Länder, the new Länder from the ex-Eastern Germany, don't have even 5% of the population composed of migrants or children of migrants, which is very, very low as compared to Hamburg, for example, where it is 28%. So this is, of course, the legacy of 40 years of communism. And if you compare now with this data, also from the 2011 census, you can see here the proportion of people who declared voluntary an affiliation to an official Christian church, and this semi-public institution they have, according to the lender. And you can see that more or less the three quarters of the population of Western Germany has declared an affiliation. This commands the key distribution of the church tax. And this goes then to the church institutions such as Caritas, German Caritas, or the Diakonie. I've had a long discussion some days ago with the president of the Diakonie in Germany. They have 4,000 employees, not counting the benevoles and not just the permanent employees. And this is, of course, linked to the concordate system, which applies in Germany. The Christian values still matter in this country and can explain, in some part, the extraordinary caritative power of Germany, which was spectacular during the migrant crisis. And you can see that the new lender was in a completely different position. The vast majority of the people didn't answer this question on religion or even explain that they had no religion. So in France, for example, Angela Merkel just 1 week after having launched her famous call to Wir schaffen das, made a statement in front of the Congress of his party saying that all the migrants are human beings. They are all children of God. Of course, this kind of argument is absolutely unthinkable in France. You cannot imagine any political leader making this kind of explanation. But in Germany, it is taken seriously. It plays a role. It's something very, very serious. And it has something to do with the fantastic capacity that Germany demonstrated to welcome migrants in big proportions, despite all the events that occurred later in a second phase. Now, let's put this immigration crisis into a broad landscape, and let's have a look at all kinds of immigration. And this is the kind of graph we can make now, quite recently, thanks to the fantastic work done by OECD. OECD now is publishing something very new, which is not only the number of foreigners who reside on a permanent basis in a country through permits of stays, but also the persons who are settled here on the basis of free circulation, because of the free circulation that obtains in Europe. And you can see here, this is just before the crisis, and this is after the crisis. Let's see before the crisis, and let's begin with the first countries, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. These countries are selecting their migrants. In dark blue, you have the person selected on the basis of the point system. They have they master to the language. They have they have a higher education certificate. They have several years of professional experience. They are not too young, not too old, etc. So it's a sort of a competition organized on the basis of human capital. And in the other blue zone correspond to their family. It's not a reunification. It's an immediate unification of selected workers and their families. And if you add up the two stripes, you arrive in Canada at 65%. 65% of the foreigners who reside permanently, the new foreigners, and this is an inflow, an annual inflow, the new correspond to selected persons. And then you have in brown the family reunification, ex post unification, okay, and in green the humanitarian or asylum treatment. If you compare with the USA, the four stripes, it's completely different.
completely different. USA is the world leader of family unification, with very few work selection and a little bit of humanitarian titles. And then let's go to France. France is a leader in Europe of family unification, 40%. And the gray area, the gray zone, corresponds to the free circulation. If you compare France with Germany, at the end of the graph, you see that Germany, that two-thirds of the foreigners who reside in Germany now are people coming from, or citizens from Europe, attracted by Germany, especially from Central Europe. So it gives you an idea of the attractive power of the economic and the society of Germany. So in comparison, proportion, twice as big as the attraction of European citizens in France. Look at, in the middle of the graph, Sweden. Sweden is has a world record of humanitarian assistance. One-third of the foreign residents have received a title on this ground. So now let's look at the following graph. But in fact, in order to better understand what happens, I will use this graph. It's the same as the one I've presented, but I've given to each country a size, the thickness of the stripe is proportional to the number of immigrants. And of course, because the United States doesn't count the same as Luxembourg, for example, or New Zealand. And so it gives you an idea of the exact proportion, and the surfaces are significant. You can see that these numbers correspond to thousands. In the United States, in 2015, 680,000 people in the world have entered into the United States on the basis of family reunification. This is a sense. And you can see that in Germany, for example, it was in France, we have 100,000 people on the same ground, which is by far the biggest introduction of family grouping and reunification in Europe. And you can see just at the beginning of the crisis, human crisis, how important is the humanitarian action of Germany. And now look at what happens in 2016. 2016 corresponds to the bulk of the immigration crisis. And you can see that Germany has fantastically, in a fantastic proportion, increased his capacity to welcome asylum seekers, but not forgetting its capacity to attract European citizens from the rest of Europe. Meanwhile, USA has still increased the number of people received on the base on the family unification, and the asylum seeking in the US, 157,000 people, is much less than what has been done in Germany. So if we look at the what happens in France, for example, how can we explain the importance of this family reunification in France and in the US as well? This is a question I will deal in the last slide. Here is the distribution of the permits of stay, the first permits of stay delivered to non-European people since 2005. I've mentioned at the end of the graph the political transitions. Nicolas Sarkozy was Minister of Interior during 5 years, 4 years, and then President of the Republic, and then Hollande. But as you can see, it doesn't matter really. We cannot say that the political powers really has an important margin of influence on the number of permits of stay delivered year after year. The major increase is the number of students, and now we try to reduce the number of students by elevating the fees. But if you look, the two in the intermediate layers, the spouses of French and family unification, it's rather stable, incredibly stable, because every 2 years we have a new legislation which harden the conditions of for spouses or children, etc., to unify. So, of course, the refugees has increased a little. It's normal, taking into account the crisis. Permanent work is more or less due to some regularization, but it's a very little proportion of the permits of stay, since because we have stopped the work, direct work immigration from the 70s, like Germany, like Sweden, like other European countries, and like Canada or New Zealand. And, well, in every good statistic, you have always an other category. I will not comment. Now, if we look, and not in detail, but just to give you an idea, what is exactly these, what are these family reasons? The spouse of French citizens is something rather easy to establish. But then parent of French citizens, it depends from the age of the child, at what age a child entered into France. It's a rather complex combination of a criteria. And then you have a dusting of different categories, and anthropologists who have followed the roots or the career, the administrative career of the immigrants through these categories, explain that in fact many of these persons who received the title for the first time in the year mentioned in fact were already residing in the country sometimes since 10 years or even more. So it's a sort of regularization which takes the form of family unification. But in fact, an important part of these people could have received asylum protection status of a refugee sooner, or even a work permit. If you look at the United States, we have more or less the same situation. It's strange to see that despite very different legal systems, the judiciary is completely different in its organization, but in fact we have a coalition of actors which more or less defends the habeas corpus of immigrants, a coalition of MPs and NGOs, etc., which more or less arrive at its results despite all the restrictive decisions taken that, yes, there is a lot of family unification. And in the case of US, we have the most refined categorization of it. There are presently, in the official statistics published by the Department of State, 247 categories of migrants. It's an incredibly detailed. For example, you have fantastic categories like non-Cuban spouses of Cuban asylees, you know, things like that, you know, which have their special category and are enumerated. Okay. And more or less, it is much more sophisticated as a French system, and because the Department of State and the publishes every year the number of applicants who everywhere in the world qualify for these categories and are waiting for permits. There are 3 million people, more than 3 million people, between 3 million and 4 million people outside the United States are presently waiting for a permit of stay. Well, 40% of them are Mexican, and many of them are in the last categories, brothers and sisters, these collateral kinship links, which does not exist in France, but exist in the United States, but with a waiting time of 20, 24 years in average for some of these categories. So it's a strange, very strange system. But it has more or less the same configuration, same result as in the French system. Instead of clarifying this, the categories, instead of saying from the beginning, okay, you can, you cannot, we accept a lot of people, provided they wait years and years, decades, sometimes, and this is how we have this result. So, I think we leave for the questions and answers more discussions about the theories that can explain this. There are seven, for example, the past dependency analysis says, okay, we have been trapped by some legal provision that has been taken two decades ago, and now we cannot change our views, things like that. I don't think it's a good interpretation. I think that, in fact, the family unification is a principle, a very strong principle, which is now in the European Convention of Human Rights. And the principle of this, of course, has been elaborated or phrased in some specific circumstance. But in fact, the Council of State in France, for example, has a dégager le principe. How to translate this? Dégager means to extract, to unveil, to bring out. To bring out a principle which was already existing, but whose consequences were not evaluated to the right measure. So I don't think we are prisoners of the past. I think we are able to face the new situation, the new regime of human rights, but also we have to reconcile this with pragmatic issues, and this maybe will be a point to discuss now. Thank you very much for your attention.
Hello, everyone. My name is Celia Belin. I'm a visiting fellow here at the Center on the United States in Europe at the Brookings Institution. And I'm delighted to be moderating this part of the evening. Mr. Héron, thank you very much for a brilliant presentation. I'm sure our audience has many questions and is impatient to grill you. I feel it was worth waiting 2 hours in line yesterday at Dulles Airport in the immigration line, which is fairly ironic. Before we engage in a conversation with you, I would like to welcome our second speaker, Anne Richard. We have asked Anne to deliver a response to Dr. Héron's remarks in order to shed a light, a different light, an American light, maybe, on those issues of immigration in Europe and beyond. And Anne made a special effort to be on stage with us tonight, and we are very grateful. Thank you very much, Anne. It is clearly a reflection of your passion for those topics. Anne, as John Allen said earlier, was between 2012 and 2017 Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration in the Obama administration. During her time in government, Anne was instrumental in fostering international cooperation on migration. Prior to joining the administration, Anne was Vice President of Government Relations and Advocacy for the International Rescue Committee. She also served at Peace Corps headquarters and the U.S. Office of Management and Budget earlier in her career. And since leaving office in January 2017, Anne has been teaching at Georgetown University. And we look forward to hearing your perspective as a policymaker on immigration in Europe and in the U.S. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you to our speaker for a really dynamic presentation. Thank you to John Allen, my friend, for welcoming both of us. And then Celia and I, Celia has been trying to get me to this platform, and we're very happy to be here. But it turned out we had the same mentor at one point, Guillaume Parmentier, who until an illness was one of the leading thinkers about U.S.-French relations. And he was, in fact, one of the founders on the Center on the United States and France that was a predecessor to the Center on the United States and Europe here at Brookings. And so I feel like this is suddenly welcome home week. So I welcome very much what Francois has said, in part because he did show the differences across Europe, and these differences have made it much more difficult to find solutions to many of the practical and political tensions that have really risen since the summer of 2015 and the very large numbers of refugees and migrants coming across from the Middle East and further afield to Europe. And Europe looked to the U.S. for solutions. The U.S. looked to Europe for solutions. And unfortunately, we don't have a very constructive story to tell in the subsequent years. I would like to say, though, that my experience within the Obama administration before 2015, the U.S. was a leader on migration issues. But we were a quiet leader in a way that diplomats can be on many issues. When the United States spoke, this is what I discovered sitting behind the placard that said United States at major international migration conferences. When the U.S. spoke, everyone listened. You could hear a pin drop in the room. This happened whenever we were discussing refugees in Geneva, but also in sort of a traveling series of international conferences and regional conferences on migration. This happened despite migration not being a key issue at the White House or in Congress or in the press or in the public. But this all changed then in 2015 and really came to a head when Alan Kurdi's body washed up on that beach in Turkey, and everyone became seized with this issue. And many of the journalists had to become overnight much more expert in this issue. And so in the subsequent years, you may hear true things about migration, you may hear false assertions about migration, but you're hearing a lot more about migration in the United States. And in some ways, this was always the norm in other countries. But in the United States, there was just a certain amount of quiet about it. We saw it really in very domestic terms and really focused on who was coming across our borders and not so much international migration issues. Our messages in the United States government were crafted through the interagency system and emphasized U.S. acceptance of immigrants, being a diverse society, and especially rights. Coming out of our government, people would speak up for human rights, for labor rights, for treating people with dignity. Now, this is not rocket science, but in these kind of international conferences, sometimes very simple statements about the importance of respecting the rights of migrants would really speak volumes. Of course, there were tensions, you know, especially over undocumented workers in the United States, but we were a good performer overall in contrast to other countries, I would maintain. And when I led interagency delegations to international conferences on migration, we had representatives from several parts of the State Department, the human rights folks, the labor special envoy, the trafficking in persons office, Department of Homeland Security always sent folks, the Labor Department's international office, U.S. Agency for International Development would send someone, usually people interested in diasporas or remittances, and then also we would generally bring someone from a think tank, like the Migration Policy Institute, Kathleen is here, or the Institute for the Study of International Migration, or from an operational NGO. So, and that alone, just showing up with someone who was not a government official, sometimes spoke volumes to other governments about how to have a conversation in one's country about migration issues. I found that other countries really put much more prominence on these issues, and some of these were countries that were sending countries. For example, the Philippines or Romania would have ministers in their cabinet who were concerned about their expatriates abroad. And in Sweden, for example, when they hosted the Global Forum on Migration and Development, they had a minister of development, and they also had a minister of migration. And so in some ways he was my counterpart, and in some ways he really, you know, he was a member of the cabinet. He far outranked me. And one of the true leaders of this conversation that was taking place was Peter Sutherland, who is now deceased, but as a former Irish attorney general, one of the founders of the World Trade Organization, you know, read his Wikipedia page, you wouldn't believe the life he's had. But he was the special representative of the Secretary General on international migration. And he played a very important role of continuing the conversation and looking for very constructive ways to solve problems and move the ball forward. And he was a delightful, very entertaining person. So he was a driving force behind good ideas and a rascally Irishman. His role today is played by Louise Arbour of Canada, who's been very busy following through on all the things launched, and some of them really initially thought up by Peter Sutherland. So when the European refugee crisis occurred, it didn't have to be a crisis, but it became certainly a political crisis. Suddenly our top partners in the world, our top partners in dealing with all sorts of crises around the world, the other major donors of the world is how I was used to thinking of a lot of the Western European countries, they suddenly turned inward. So what has changed, and one of the things President Obama did was to organize and lead a leaders summit in September 2016 at the United Nations. There were 2 days, a UN day on September 19th that came up with the New York Declaration, launched the Global Compact on Migration, the Global Compact on Refugees process that ended recently. And then there was a day that President Obama led trying to get the countries of the world to commit to do more to help refugees. What has happened since? Well, already in the Trump campaign, we had a lot of anti-refugee, anti-immigrant, and really hostile language that continues to this day, and you've all heard it. Invasion, crisis, rapists, Middle Eastern terrorists, MS-13, shithole countries, and of course the big exception is Norwegians. We love Norwegians. Sorry. The Trump administration has done a number of things, and I think you're probably more used to hearing about the anti-refugee actions, the travel ban, drastic cuts in resettlement. They stopped funding for certain UN agencies in addition to UN Population Fund, also the one that provides assistance to Palestinian refugees, UNRWA. Attorney General put out Justice Department guidance to not give asylum to women fleeing intimate partner violence, and which had been the case for several years, or people fleeing criminal gangs. And this has become very controversial then, the Central Americans fleeing north. Do they deserve an opportunity to claim asylum in accordance with the International Refugee Convention? There were also anti-immigrant, and you're aware of the, you know, the main focus on that has been about the Dreamers. But, you know, with someone like Stephen Miller in the White House, he is leading a whole series of things against refugees, against immigrants, and to the point where senators said, we can't get anything done if Stephen Miller is in the room. But also anti-migrant. And here's the examples where, and then I'll finish up. The U.S. early on withdrew from the Global Compact on Migration. It was supposed to go to a conference that, like I said, we did all the time. You never heard about them. But the Trump administration withdrew because they said this voluntary agreement would impinge on our sovereignty, which was nonsense. The U.S. did not engage on this major world effort. We did participate on negotiations on the Global Compact on Refugees, but then walked away from it at the end. The U.S. also
diplomatically asked other countries to give up on the global climate, the global compact on migration, and convinced Hungary, Poland, Austria, Italy, Bulgaria, Australia, and Israel not to sign on. We had traditionally led the International Organization for Migration. That was led by an American, most recently by Ambassador William Swing, a revered and influential international diplomat. The Trump administration put forward Ken Isaacs from Samaritan's Purse. Samaritan's Purse is a North Carolina-based international humanitarian organization that's faith-based. It was created by Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son. And he lost the election to Portuguese official Antonio Vitorino because he had tweeted out a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric. And you cannot run an international organization if you do not have respect for a very large segment of the world's population. Meanwhile, Germany has become a major player, increased donations to UNHCR. It's the number two donor now. It chaired, along with Morocco for 2 years, the Global Forum on Migration Development. It chaired the follow-on to a climate migrant initiative called the Nansen Initiative. They chaired the platform for disaster displacement, and now Bangladesh is the chair and France is the vice chair. And they have really put a great deal of focus on integration and trying to all those people who came to find ways to make them part of German society in a way that will work. I think the impact of the Trump policies has been to aid right-wing governments in Europe. I also think, though, they have, without a vote in Congress, managed to discard a key component of America's identity. And that really has shocked me. So why don't I stop there?
Yeah, thank you, Anne. I think it raises many questions. We'll go back to many of them, in particular the reaction of our Western democracies in front of the European refugee crisis. But maybe I'll kick off this conversation with a few questions, and I'll start with you, Dr. Héron. Our lecture series is named after the renowned French intellectual Raymond Aron, who was altogether a philosopher, a sociologist, a historian, a journalist. And at the time of Aron, intellectuals around him were guided by ideology, in particular communism. But Aron really stood out for his constant skepticism and for his refusal to obey simplified truths, just to pay respect to a certain ideology. You have authored a very interesting book in 2017 called Avec l'immigration, With Immigration, in which you argue that it is futile to be either for or against immigration, as immigration is a reality. You plead for a committed neutrality, and you see your job as a scientist as providing objective analysis for policymaking. But we just discussed it. Today's debates are heavily ideological. How do you see the recent evolution of the debate, and how can we move to a discussion based on facts, as you presented today, and reality instead of ideology?
Well, there are two contradictory trends by now. On the one hand, the development of fake news, and we've seen this particular, all the attacks against the Global Compact of Marrakesh, and all the vision that have been that have circulated about this. But on the other hand, we have also this huge movement of fact-checking. Of course, even the Front National, now Rassemblement National, has its own fact-checking tribune in his review. But it's striking that precisely, for example, when there was this polemics about the Global Compact, many journalists restored the truth, explaining exactly the status of this document and the importance it had. And so we have these two conflicting trends. So I think that the cultural fight is not over. We have to continue. And my role as an expert is to
to give to the public debate, to fuel the public debate with simple data and eloquent data, something everybody can understand. And I hope that this, that tonight it has been. But of course, my problem now is that our political leaders are extremely prudent, including President Macron. And it's very difficult to find any statement which tries to explain exactly what happens. For example, to say, okay, we are not the most generous country in Europe for asylum seeking. Even if we take into account only the number of applicants and not the number of refugees, the persons who obtain the status of refugee, we are still at the 13th position in Europe, and controlling for the size of the population, which is very... Okay. So I think that in the public debate, especially now, we at the eve of the European elections, we should have a public speech from the highest authority much more keen to the data, to the realities. We cannot deny the existence of migration. Now, more or less a quarter of the French population is either immigrant or child of at least one immigrant, a quarter. In Germany, it's more or less the same proportion. In the United States, it's a little more, 27, something like that, if you sum up the two generations. So all the ideas that, well, let's calculate what the immigration cost to us, consists in trying to calculate what is exactly the cost of a quarter of the population for the three other quarters, which is absurd. So if you consider the order of magnitude of immigration, the fact that we have arrived at a point that now it's irreversible, we cannot imagine a world without immigration. It's absolutely impossible. And so we have to face this in a correct way. A lot of problems do exist. The integration of the second generation, the commitment to values, to ethical values, which all religions do not necessarily consider without a special effort, and so on and so on. But I think that the general scene is that, okay, immigration is here, and we have to face it, we have to do with it, and that's it. And this should be stated, should be claimed more vigorously, I think, by the political authorities.
So just a follow-up question. Among the claims, the French authorities are not necessarily making that particular claim, but President Macron has talked about his desire to transform France's migration policy from, as you showed, a policy of mostly family reunification into some sort of Canadian model of work migration primarily, plus associated families. But in your book, you explain that contrary to what populists promise, it is actually impossible to change overnight the immigration of a country. And I'd like to know, given that the explanation you might be giving, uh-huh, if Macron is really capable of changing migration policy, or is there a sort of a fatalism there in the recognition that it is what it is and changing government does not change the fact of migration policy?
I think that by now he has not very clear ideas about the topic. It's not really a priority for him. And if you look at his campaign book, Révolution, there was only some allusions to the immigration issues, not very precise. And the candidate which had the most, by far, detailed information on immigration issues was Alain Juppé. But it did not work. In fact, there is the Canadian model is now often cited, for example, during the parliamentary debate about the recent law on asylum and immigration. But people don't understand what is the Canadian model. They believe in France that Canadian has quota to diminish migration. It's exactly the opposite. the Canadian quotas are objectives, and the objective is more or less to have each year selected migrants which correspond to 1% of the Canadian population. 330,000 new immigrants selected. And because it's more or less 1% of the Canadian population. In France, it would correspond to 650,000 immigrants each year, which is selected for on the ground of their work skills. The Canadian system is very special because de facto it eliminates the vast majority of the Hispanics because they don't have the level of education which is required, they don't have the professional experience required, and so on, and they don't master English and French. Okay, so and the Canada can afford, if it can offer itself this luxury of selecting its migrant, because they have one and only one neighboring country at the south border, United States, 10 times more populated than them, which de facto integrates a Hispanic population, whatever the level of skills. So this is possible when you are a peripheral country. It's not a coincidence if the other countries which select migrants are Australia, New Zealand.
So geography plays a role.
Two other peripheral countries, yeah. Isolated countries. The weight of the geographical factors is very important. The same for the British, for example, but not to the same extent, of course. So I think that the Canadian model cannot be generalized. And in the field of ethics, you know that the Kantian criterion that a principle can be ethical if it can be reversed, if everybody can claim it. If it's only a situation resting on position de rente, on a specific position, it's not ethical. So the Canadian system could not work without the support of the United States, indirect support of the United States. And this is very important too. And so every time I can, I repeat this to the French deputies who are tempted to. Just one brief remark. For example, Senator Carucci, an intelligent man, one of the leaders of the government right, let's say, has presented an amendment in the last debate on the law on immigration, saying, okay, France should, on the Canadian model, the Parliament should vote every year the number of immigrants we should welcome corresponding to our receiving capacities. And these receiving capacities will be defined by experts, objective experts. So, of course, I felt concerned by this on the basis of economic criteria, demography criteria, and so on and so on. Okay, but if you do so, if you, for example, you consider that a reasonable objective could be the average of observed in across Europe, you should multiply by two the number of asylum seekers to whom you could give a status of refugee and not divide us. So they don't understand that the Canadian quotas, in fact, it's the paradox of Canada that it selects migrants without reducing the numbers, sans bargainer sur le nombre.
It's an expensive model, a restricted model. Let me turn to Anne. Anne, you, during your time in the administration, you recall that you were at the heart of migration and refugee issues, including during the European refugee crisis. And I want to take you back to this time, which were particularly difficult politically, but also from a humanitarian standpoint. And recalling Raymond Aron once again, Raymond Aron was deeply convinced that intellectuals needed to provide policy options, even when they were far from perfect. There's a famous quote by Aron that political action is not the choice between good and evil, but between the preferable and the detestable. So I was wondering what you thought of our Western democracy's response to this crisis. Was it adequate? Was it even ethical? And what could Europe and the U.S. have done better or differently?
Well, I think before the crisis, already President Obama had been called a deporter-in-chief. And so he was being attacked from the left for carrying out U.S. laws to deport people who had arrived and did not have a good claim, did not have a credible claim. And so there was, I think that he was living in that Aranist area between, you know, not a perfect policy from a human rights standpoint, but trying to balance different pressures. And what I would say in terms of giving us all a grade in how we responded to the large numbers coming across the summer of 2015, we did not do well at all. And I think for us at the time in the U.S. government, we were surprised by how difficult it appeared for Brussels to organize an effective response. And it did, you know, promote ideas, but the member, EU member countries did not comply. So the most dynamic nation at the time, as you said earlier, was Germany. We have very close relations with Germany. We had a very skilled ambassador at the time, who instantly tried to find ways to bridge between the U.S. and Germany in helping come up with ideas for the Germans to deal with so many newcomers coming in at once. The key difference between everything happening in Europe and discussions about people coming to the U.S. was that large numbers had walked across Europe without being screened. And in the and there was a fear, especially after the Paris attacks of November 13th, there was a fear these people would just keep walking across the Atlantic Ocean and carry out terrorist attacks in the United States. And you would have thought, you know, Paris was sort of right past Miami or something, that it was so close there that it was an American city. So there was a piece of that that was good, that so many Americans care about what happens in Paris. But there was a piece of it that was unreal and very much exaggerated concerns about refugees being likely terrorists carrying out attacks in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I think when history looks back and examines this period, I think the disappointment many of us felt that we weren't coming up with really solid solutions will be also the conclusion of historians. So the thing that we did that got a lot of support from leading figures in Europe was the President Obama's decision to really make attention to refugees such an important part of his last UN General Assembly meeting. The problem there was that the following administration did not continue that, but instead has set the whole course the opposite way around. But UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which is the UN Refugee Agency's formal name, and the World Bank are, in fact, using the commitments that countries made at that time to follow up and to discuss ways, you know, to keep trying to make progress on how the world deals with refugees and migrants. So there's a lot of international diplomats who have taken this groundwork that was laid in 2016 and advanced it. But, you know, what we're all hearing in the newspaper and on the radio waves, et cetera, is Twitter feeds, is, you know, a lot of really hostile rhetoric coming from many, many different segments of our societies and in some cases from leaders in governments.
Thank you. I'd like to open the floor to the room for questions. Please raise your hand, wait for the microphone, which is around, and identify yourself by name, and please keep it short. Just one question, Kathleen. In the front.
Thank you very much. I'm Kathleen Newland from the Migration Policy Institute, and I have a question for Dr. Errant. If you believe polling data, which I don't always, the policies of the current administration are not in line with American public opinion, which is still fairly positive toward refugees, favors legalization of migrants who've been here a long time and so on, and is fairly positive about migration. The question I wanted to ask you is how much the position of the French government as reflected in admissions is reflective of public opinion in France. In other words, are leaders being led by public opinion, or are they leading it? Thank you.
I immediately answer. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, we have in France what has been observed in all liberal democracies, the famous policy gap. You know this notion. It means that all liberal democracies, without any exception, do welcome more migrants, systematically more migrants, than the public opinion would admit and than the political themselves will admit. There is always more migrants than is expected and desired by the public opinion and by the political spheres. And this is one of the major points of research now. And one of the explanations is that, okay, but the public opinion and the political class, let's say, underestimate the importance of the international commitments mm-hmm. and the importance of the rights-based immigration. For example, we have very frequently in every electoral campaign, in all the programs, you can look at the primaries and the presidential campaign we had in 2 years ago, and many of these programs say, oh, we should have received only the migrants who are strictly adjusted to the needs of our economy. Okay? This kind of sentence. But the idea that immigration should be correlated with the economy is no longer obtained since the 70s. Since the time we took the decision, and the same in Germany, they took the decision to stop the work immigration. And since that time, in the old immigration countries, such as Germany, the Netherlands, Switzerland, France, etc., there is no correlation any longer between the business cycle and the immigration flows. Okay, this kind of thing is systematically ignored. But it explains why we continue to receive migrants, because the vast majority of migrants migrate because they have the right to, because they have the family unification. Even if we multiply the obstacles to harden the conditions, etc., you have this. Okay, and if you want to reduce drastically the number of migrants coming on the ground of the family unification. For example, Marine Le Pen wanted to divide this by 10 and then by 20, reducing the 200,000 permits to 10,000, which means the abolition of migration. Okay, there is no, it's more or less equivalent. But even François Fillon, for example, mentioned a drastic reduction of family grouping. Some of the leaders of Les Républicains are dreaming about the fact that we could reduce to the extreme this. The problem is, how can you divide a right by 2? How can you divide a right by 10? The only way is to claim in the most solemn way that, okay, now France, the country of the human rights and so on, will officially announce that we resiliate the all the international conventions on family grouping, on the rights of the children, and so on and so on. Do you imagine that France could do such a thing? This is also policy, but policy at a higher level, not the kind of policy you can change by some electoral campaign or from overnight. It's something much more stable. And so I think that it would be, it should be one of the role of the of political leaders to stress, to insist on this, the motors of the immigration in our countries. And there is still a coupling, a correlation between migration flows and business cycle is a new in the new immigration countries, such as Spain or Italy or Greece. And, for example, the most wonderful example we had was the subprime crisis that in Spain burst in 1 year the business bubble and the migrant bubble. It's very spectacular. But this is possible only in the new immigration country, not in the old immigration country like France, Germany. So this is the... why we will not, we will always have this situation of a gap between the public opinion and what is really between the outputs, the political outputs, speeches, laws, etc., and the real outcomes of the migration policy.
Okay, let's take more over there in the back.
Hello. Thank you for this enlightening conversation. Have you not noticed by any chance that maybe except to diehard gullibles, your narrative increasingly rings hollow? Too bad I don't have time to debunk your arguments, of course, but the days of bringing in the Muslim demographic bomb is coming to an end across Europe as more and more people see what it's all about. And the thing is, I want to congratulate you, by the way, because right now, of course, you know, it's falling flat. Merkel is on pre-retirement. Macron is a politically, you know, basically walking dead. Okay, and so this game is over. Now, by the way, I want to congratulate
okay,
you extra.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, could you kindly comment on the fact that the second largest church in Paris was set on fire this weekend? Okay, this is the kind of wonderful things you have achieved.
Thank
Never mind Stockholm being the world rape capital of the world. Keep it up.
Alina, good luck.
Hi, I'm Alina Polyakova. I'm Celia's colleague in the Center of the United States in Europe here at Brookings. Thank you for the fascinating conversation. I wanted to ask you to maybe think one level above the migration numbers, because it has always struck me about the differences between all of the European countries that you so clearly showed, the types of migrants admitted, the proportions of migrants. Is that regardless of those numbers, you know, immigration and opposition to immigration has become the key rallying call for mobilizing, you know, the far-right populists that become anti-immigrant party across Europe. And to go even deeper than that, what you showed in the breakdown in Germany, the district breakdown or the Länder breakdown, is that the AfD in Germany is, of course, strongest in the areas where there is the lowest number of immigration. And you could say the same thing for Hungary or Poland, where I think your number was 14 asylum seekers were admitted in 1 year, which is in itself telling. So I was wondering if you had specifically been able to make that link in a more methodological way. I know you have to dig down much deeper, and I'd be curious specifically if you had done that kind of research on France, looked at the district level data and mapped it on top of support for the National Front, if you were able to see that in areas that are more homogenous, that you had more support. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
In the interest of time, let's take a third question. Bill?
Bill Drozdiak. A question about the future and the impact on climate change. World Bank says 250 million people will be on the move as opposed to 65 million. today. Lake Chad is drying up. Millions of people who live off of Lake Chad are going to be on the move. And these projections have been seized upon by populist nationalist leaders like Matteo Salvini to whip up growing fears. Even though the number of immigrants into Italy has dramatically reduced, his popularity keeps growing up because he plays on these projections. So I'd like to hear both of you give your opinions on, as to how we can best perceive these projections and also their political impact.
Okay, and maybe Anne, if you want also to comment on American public opinion regarding immigration, including in a region maybe more so hostile to immigration when there is less migrant actually. Mm-hmm. François, do you want to start?
Yes. You know, there are two competing theories to explain the importance of the resentment against immigrants. The first idea is most common. It consists in saying that there is a sort of threshold, a tolerance threshold, and if the proportion of migrants is climbing and clearing a certain threshold, then xenophobia will burst, etc. And the other theory is a theory of the called sometimes the contact theory, that if you are familiarized with migrants, if you have the experience, personal experience of migrants, you're much more tolerant. And this, the contact theory has been illustrated by the German case. Because yes, it is precisely in the areas where you have not even 5% of the population, including the two generation, that the xenophobic movement surge. So the first immigrant which appears in the landscape is already a threat, whereas in Hamburg or in the north or in Westphalia, etc., of course, the far right also has reaped some, but not at all in the same proportion as there are other sources, of course, of discontentment of in Eastern Germany, and it's very difficult to isolate a variable and to weight exactly how this factor is really playing. But we have an incredible story in France which also militates for the contact theory. It is a rumor, a very strange rumor, which has been observed in some regions in the west of France and in the northeast, around Poitiers, Niort, these little cities of the southwest France, where there was a very, very low percentage of immigrants and no African immigrants, because the African immigrants are very much concentrated in the Parisian region, you know, and also in Champagne, around the Champagne, Ardennes, etc. And the rumor said that, well, these Africans that are appearing now, they did not exist before. They are here because the municipality of the suburban region in Paris sold these immigrants to the municipalities of the receiving regions. And so there was a sort of trade-off market, etc. It's a strange, very strange rumor. It is very well documented in Wikipedia, La Rumeur du 92. It is called the rumor of the 9-3, the rumor of 93 is number of Saint-Denis department, which is by far the department where with more migrants. And the idea that these departments have sold out their excess migrants from black countries, from black Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, to these municipalities. And to the point that the mayors of these municipalities, and some of them were belonging to the right, Benoît Paru, the mayor of a city in Champagne, Ardennes, suited the some NGOs, some groups for this. So the mere apparition, the first apparition of a stranger, visible stranger, the color of the skin plays a very important role, was putting the people in a new state. And I think that the main reason for me of the opposition to migrants in the ex-communist country is that communism has created enfermé les peuples. How would you tell it in English?
Jailed.
Has jailed the people. There was no. They only has locked the people. The only migration possible was a work migration. Family unification was prohibited. And this is very important to remind that the only countries in which family reunification is prohibited are the Gulf countries and the communist country before the fall of the wall. The only historical examples. In a liberal democracy, family unification exists by rights. Okay. So the communism has completely isolated the peoples, and they have never been familiarized with the existence of non-European people working with them and helping for the economic reconstruction. And this is a very important support for me to the contact theory, which explains the facts much more directly than the threshold theory.
Do you want to answer on the climate?
And yes, the climate. Well,
because we have only
I'm not at all a climate skeptic, not at all. I think that the change, present change of climate has a human origin. It's now very clear. But I'm very skeptical about the idea of climate migration. And the number you have mentioned, 250, is always the same. It comes from a Stern report. We don't know exactly what is the origin of this figure. And the problem is that the definition of migration in this idea, which looks like a rumor by some, is a very specific definition, because how can we be sure that, for example, the elevation of the sea level, which is a very progressive mechanism, that a phenomenon like Katrina, for example, or earthquakes in Haiti and so on, how, to what extent can we be sure that this will provoke international migration, not simply displacement to the rear country? We don't know. We have no evidence of this by now. Of course, we can always mention the Maldives. How do you say in English, Maldives?
Maldives.
Yeah. Maldives. But, well, this is a very specific country and a very few population. So the problem with this natural phenomena that their chronology is very different. You have sudden events. In 2 seconds, an earthquake destroys a population. Or you have progressive events which takes decades or centuries. In each case, we have no. There is no evidence that really this will provoke a climate migration. I have to comment this because what is very striking now is the success of both theories. A theory that there are some demographic migrations. And there are some climate migration. That is objective migration, objective facts. You don't even you don't need to hierarchize the civilizations or the races or to have a cultural vision of the threats. No, it suffices now to give you a sort of objective vision of the threat. There are some demographic migration or climate migration. If you look at migrations from a demographic point of view, there is a fantastic tool now available since a few years, the Bilateral Migration Database, which classifies all the migrants between the countries of birth and the countries of residence. And it's a coherent matrix, you know, made up by OECD, IMF, United Nations, and so on. And what is the lesson we can draw from this matrix? That it's not the poorest of the poorest country which migrate to the rich country. Not at all. 75% of the sub-Saharan African sub-Saharan migrations are directed towards another country of sub-Saharan Africa. So if you look, for example, not only the indicator of the wealth of the country, but also, for example, the fertility. The countries with the highest fertility don't migrate to the countries with the lowest fertility. We have these mechanical ideas, these mechanical metaphors, these hydraulic metaphors of that what is overcrowded will mechanically goes to the the deserts, or the dry to the wet, or the over fertile to the over fertile, and so on. But look, for example, at the Balkan countries, and this would be my last remark. If you look at all the ex-communist Balkan countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, Kosovo, these countries, 22% of this population lives abroad. It's one of the most important outflow of migrants in the world. 22% of the Balkan countries, the Western Balkan countries, Africa, it's only 2% or 3% of the sub-Saharan Africa which lives outside. And the Balkan countries have the highest records of the lowest low fertility, as demographers say. So this lowest low country by the criterion of fertility do migrate in a massive way to a country with higher fertility. So if every time you look at these metaphors, hydraulic metaphors, mechanical metaphors, they are eloquent, but a metaphor is not true because it is eloquent.
Thank you very much, and I think we don't have much more time for any question, but I'd like to give a chance to Anne to maybe interject, if you want, on both the question of American public opinion, and in general reflect on your own take of this administration immigration policies. You've mentioned it a bit earlier, but that we can see clear anti-immigrant policies. But what if, is there anything that this administration can do that would make sense if it does want to fight illegal immigration but do respect the rights of the people in this country? And maybe just a few words and to conclude.
On the issue of climate migrants, one of the problems we have is that all of the international conventions and organizations are set up to deal with people fleeing good old-fashioned conflict and persecution. And so there is no home for these issues, you know, in the international community of organizations and point people. And there's so much going on that no one wants to take it on either. So that's why I appreciate the countries that have Norway and Switzerland, Germany and Morocco and Bangladesh, you know, stepping forward to look at these issues. I find in Washington, and my MPI friends will correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, there's very few experts wrestling with these issues. It's mentioned a lot. But really sitting down doing serious research, I would say my colleague Elizabeth Ferris at Georgetown is, and also Alice Thomas of Refugees International. So I think there could be a lot more attention paid to the issues that, Bill, you raised. One of the things that we talked about with the ambassadors in 2015 and 2016 was to that they be comfortable talking about the American tradition of being welcoming to refugees and immigrants, but that we also had another tradition, which was once a group had arrived in the U.S., they joined with other Americans to shut the door to the next group coming. And that this was also a tradition we had had over decades and decades, and each group would try to do it to the next group. And the reason was because while this most recent arrivals, okay, they will fit in our country and in our society, this next group, no way can they be trusted to join our society. And if you go back and look at the rhetoric, it really resembles a rhetoric against Muslims and against Central Americans today, that somehow there's just something innate about them that they couldn't possibly fit in our society. And so, you know, that they are a threat to Christianity or that they're rapists. That's the type of language we've heard today, but also that you will hear in Europe and in the United States. So it's if those are concerns, I mean, there's other ways to to fight rape. It doesn't have to be done through your immigration and migration policies. The president has talked against chain migration, and that is an acceptable term, but it could also be called family reunification. And I think one reason America has endorsed family reunification for so long is it was part of many American families had arrived because one person would come first and send money home, get a job, make some money, and send money home to have the next family member and the next family member and the next family member, so that it was a normal process, you know, from the 1800s. I guess if you wanted to discuss in the United States, and if the Trump administration wanted to discuss this, I wouldn't trust them, but if they wanted to discuss this seriously, that they could talk about the mix of people could come in. I think there's a legitimate question there about who do we want and, you know, what are our priorities. I would just caution, you know, the refugees who come to the United States are by and large very successful, and many of them come with nothing. So I'm just not that impressed that we have to have, you know, I think the president would say real estate investors and supermodels as a priority coming in or marrying. So I think that, you know, many people can do well in the United States. What Europe should be looking at, what Americans should be looking at, is why do we have different levels of fluidity within our society? Why do some migrants do very well in some countries and less well? Why are they frozen? I mean, when I lived in France just for a short time, but I was really struck by the banlieue and how the political parties at the time, I think it's changed in the last 15 years, just, you know, ignored. They had no political power, people living in these suburban areas around the cities. The funny thing I saw once was a guy who was darker skinned, was in the subways once, and he had a T-shirt, and he'd written on it, "I'm from the suburbs," to show what a tough guy he was. And I thought, that would never translate into Washington, you know? That's not how we roll. But I think this is where we should be looking deeper is, you know, how, no matter who's in your country, how do we allow for this, you know, American dream, this upward mobility, this rewards for hard work? Because I think that is the essential problem that a lot of the discontented publics have right now.
I feel terrible that we're out of time. This has been a brilliant conversation. Thank you both for being here. Thank you, all of you, for joining us and join me in thanking you.